Kaya, and welcome to the Curb Podcast. My name is Andrew Pierce, and this podcast is produced in Boorloo, Perth, Western Australia. Sovereignty never ceded. Ruby O'Sullivan Belfridge is a writer and critic who works and plays on unceded Wurundjeri land. In the wake of After Wars screening at the Sydney Film Festival, Ruby spoke with director Birgit Steiremuus about the impact she hopes the film has, the nature of truth, and how truly annoying the question of genre can be. Ruby writes about After War, saying, "After War broadens the notion of the language in which cinema can speak to a viewer. It features a stunningly subversive soundtrack from Christian Selin Ednis Andersen and Erik K. Skvadvin. It soars over audiences' attempts to categorize and classify it. Steiremuus is not only aware of this, but After War shows its audience just how much they are normally allowed to hide from accountability. After War began as a short film in the years following the Kosovo War at the turn of the century. Some 15 years later, Steiremuus returned to the relationship she forged with Kosovo's youth to document the continuation of their stories in a feature-length film. After War's protagonists speak to us directly about their lived reality in a post-war Kosovo. They also act out scenes from their lives, sometimes alongside other hired actors, and sometimes with participants, real family members. This structure builds a unique impression of story, a sensation of real and intense connection with the film's subjects or actors, the people, really, behind whatever label the crime of analysis will beg we use to comprehend them." I urge you to head over to thecurb.com.au to read Ruby's full review of After War, and to find further interviews and reviews from other writers like myself. The Curb is proudly an ad-free website and relies on community support to stay active. To help keep us supportive and active and alive, head over to patreon.com/thecurbau, where you can show your support from as little as $1 a month. For now, here is the trailer for After War, followed by Ruby's interview with Birgit.
Isha të lutën një valë, bari ishte I gjatë. Atëheri këm po qenë të rrugës, të ngaj të le. Më të rem, të lutë me të ato indikë, qëndë. Sa një fundit që ka bo, është me lutë me ta. Pastaj brit me nëmës tem, si ojkë. Qysh mund është me harruat, ndjore.
I hadn't experienced the sort of power of the connection that I had with those characters that were depicted on screen in a documentary before. I found it quite amazing. But it's not quite a documentary, is it? It's
No.
Would you classify it as a docu-fiction, or how would you term it?
You know, we've obviously been discussing it a lot. You know, and I'm not a documentarian, so I'm actually a little bit uncomfortable calling it a documentary.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how to do documentaries. Well, I kind of do, but I don't make them, you know. So, and I do think that working as a fiction director and a documentary director is quite different. You know, the way you work is quite different. I think people sometimes think, so it's just everyone is a director, but I do think there's some differences, and some interesting differences. And I definitely come from the fiction angle. I mean, I think in terms of labeling the film, I would like to call it a film.
I suppose it doesn't need a label, does it? Like, it is a bit genre defying, and that's kind of, I guess, the label that it attracts.
Exactly. So it's trying not to fall, you know, it's playing with a genre, so it's a little bit, you know, annoying is a bit word, but it's a little bit annoying to have to give it a label when it's actually trying not to have a label. You know?
It's part of its magic, actually, is that it's, it definitely has a bit of, like, it's got such a strength of character that it's sort of part of its personality that it can't be put in a box, I think.
Exactly, and I think as soon as you put it in a box, it becomes a little academic, you know. You know, if you say docu-fiction, it opens up a question of, like, well, what's documentary and what's fiction? And I don't know if that question is so interesting, you know. You know, like, at least it's not, I certainly didn't make it something that the audience can really figure out truly.
Hmm.
So it's maybe even a frustrating question for an audience. So, you know, and if you call it a hybrid, it's okay, but that is also a little bit of a dry term, you know, and it is a drama. I mean, I think if I had to sort of for myself describe it, I would say it's a drama with real people and about real people, you know, but that's because I come from the fiction angle. So I would sort of say it's a drama, but it's actually more true than most dramas.
Yeah, you know, there's a magic place, you know, in between truth and fiction, I think, which is really hard to label because it does defy a kind of description.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, with all filmmaking, you know, I think the question of what's true and what's not true is a really important question. Always, no matter what you do. And I think there's a lot of media being made, especially these days. I mean, maybe I'm just getting old when I say this, but there's a lot of content, we could call it, to be really nasty, being made that, you know, that sometimes forget that truth is also important. You know, that there should be some truth, and it can be an emotional truth in a performance, or it can be a truth in terms of the universe, or it can be a truth in terms of recognizing a storyline, or it can be a truth in terms of character.
Mm.
And in this case, there's a sort of undeniable truth in the film, which is their story, their testimony.
Mm.
You know, it's not an exact truth. You know, it's a more general truth, which means that actually that it applies to more people, which I think makes it a bigger truth.
Mm. It's something that maybe can be felt and not described. The impact, I think, for me, when I was watching it, it was a feeling that I was left with rather than a capacity to have a conversation even, you know.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in the making of the film, you know, I wasn't so concerned about sort of the specific truths, you know, like, did this guy really experience exactly this thing this way?
Mm.
You know, which is sort of a documentary question, right?
Mm.
You don't want to fuss around too much with that if you make a traditional documentary, you know, because then you kind of lose the truth of what you're doing.
That's so interesting that fact can be repellent to truth. It's sort of surprising, but yeah.
Yeah, but I sort of didn't deal with the truth that way. I dealt with it a little more broadly, which is there's a fate that some people, these and others, experience, you know, and there's a truth in that fate.
Hmm.
You know, they can tell it, other people can also tell it. You know, so it's not a private truth. You know, I think there's some very hard-hitting and really wonderful documentaries where it's just this one person who can tell this one story.
Mm.
You know, and I think traditional documentary is often that. You know, it's one person can tell this one story.
Mm.
You know, and it becomes very strong because it's this one person who can tell this one story.
Mm.
You know, I think this film is more an attempt to tell a collective story, you know, a story that's more about a group. And that's why, I mean, even when I did the short 15 years ago, that was like one of my sort of anchors in the process was it's a collective story, you know, so it's a collective story, it's a collective story, it's a collective story. So it's always, you know, if it's true for the collective, it's true, but it doesn't happen. Be true for the individual. So in the old film, I had a monologue where Lul Sim, who's not in the new film, he says, you know, when I was born, it was snowing. You know, he has a story about the snow. It's not his story. You know, I have no idea what month he was born in.
Yeah.
Sun could have been shining. So it's actually really false, specifically about him.
Yeah.
But it's there for a poetic reason. You know, to sort of give an audience a sense that, you know, we all have some image or some poetic right over our own birth story, you could say.
That's a really, it's an interesting idea, especially in these like modern times. I think, you know, some have forgotten how to tell a story, you know, like, yeah, you mentioned before, there is such a, like, content is everywhere and content is not storytelling. And yeah, it is almost like we have to sort of retrain ourselves to tell story and to hear story in a way, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, I also think, I mean, storytelling, for me, one of the purposes of storytelling is that we can understand our complicated lives better. You know, that's like a basic, I think it's a basic, that's why it's not a luxury occupation, you know, because I think it is connected to, you know, to understanding who we are and how we live our lives. And of course, then if you have storytelling that becomes too detached from that, you kind of lose that role that it needs to play. I think it's like necessary. You know, I think it's necessary. Like I was saying to my husband the other day, I was like, there's so much dystopian shit, you know, like what's with the dystopia, you know, like, and you know, so we're sitting here having to reflect on our own lives in dystopia, you know. But
yeah, like there's not enough of that to go around anyway, right?
Exactly. And it scares me a bit, you know, like I feel like, you know, I think it's very, you know, it makes our lives disappear a bit, right? You know, and I think the same you could say, just to get back to the film, so it doesn't become too much about what I think, but you know, with the film, you know, it's also, it's, the film is a way of giving voice to something that we'd rather not think about. So in a way, the film is also made to speak at a Western audience, you know, sort of an at. And sometimes it's a little aggressive in that tone.
Yeah, I mean, it uses gaze in a very strong way and a very unique way, I think. Because you know, the subjects are literally speaking to the audience member, and I felt like I had formed a relationship with them by the end.
Yes, and I would prefer for that relationship to be a little bit complicated. Yeah, you know, so I purposely didn't want it to be just, you know, you can sit here and you can feel sorry for them, or you can feel like, oh my God, I'm so happy I saw, now I can feel something for them. I really wanted you to feel a little more uncomfortable than that, you know, and a little confronted, so that you think about it a little more deeply, hopefully, in some cases, you know, also about your own role. Like, so, because I think, you know, we do have a certain survival mechanism in our lives, which is we see something terrible and then we can feel sadness, empathy, pity, a bit of uproar. And then we can, you know, we can go through these cycles of emotional response, which actually, you know, it's kind of about us starting to feel better and being able to move on. It's actually, if you want to be really nasty, you could say it's like a cycle of being able to forget.
Yeah. Like a quick metabolizing of what you're witnessing.
Yeah. There's certain catharsis in it, you know, so for that reason, I can also get uncomfortable with, you know, being very sort of inundated with horrible footage, for example, because I think, you know, I mean, we have Gaza right now, you know, it's just, there's a numbing effect because people can go through these cycles of like, oh my God, it's so horrible. Oh my God, I feel so bad. Oh my God, the children. And after a while, people sort of go through those cycles and feel like they've done something. Actually, they've done nothing. You know, that in itself, you know, so that's why in the film, I think that even one character says specifically, which is words I wrote, you know, and asked them to say, you know, because I felt that's their truth. It's I don't need your pity, you know, like I don't, you know, so it's as much about the audience as it's about the characters in the film.
How did you balance the things that you wanted the characters to say with what they came up with and how they contributed?
I mean, it's like a long, very slow process, actually. You know, so first of all, you know, I've known them for 15 years. So there's and so has my crew. You know, so we're a group of people. It's not just me. We're a group of people. Some people are in Kosovo, and I'm here. One person is in Sweden. You know, so we're a little gang who have known each other for 15 years, which is them and us. So, and I think the fact that we filmed with them when they were children and know what they went through and put in the effort to make a film about it, which means that it still exists, what they went through, which in their lives, it doesn't exist anymore because they don't talk about it. So when they say in the film, I don't talk to my mother, that's true. They don't. Like, they don't talk about it in the families, and they don't talk about it to anybody they know. It's kind of, you know, obviously now with the film, it's not a secret, but it is a secret. You know, it's a shame that's in their past. But because we knew them and recognized it, not as something shameful, but as something that they went through, we have sort of a shared history with that. Which puts us in a slightly different position than other people in their lives, I would say. You know, it's not, you know, it's not a question of more or less important, or it's just different. You know, it's a different position we're in. And then in going back and deciding to make a longer film, you know, it was over a period of 5 or 6 years. You know, I first approached them, I showed them the old film again. I talked to them about their lives today. With the old film, I never, on purpose, we didn't engage with their families. Like, we only engaged with them because we felt it was a complicated relationship between them and their parents and the whole being sent out on the streets. And we just wanted to sort of keep as much as we could sort of a clear connection to them. So we also didn't film with their parents, and the parents are not in the film. But I thought, once they were adults, I got very curious. I've always been very curious, you know. But and I did meet some families, but many of them I never met. I just met the kids. And so we had a period where we would go and visit, you know, to the extent that they wanted us to come to the home. We'd go and visit, we'd take some pictures, we'd talk, you know, so there would be sort of an observational stage of me seeing what are their lives really like. Some of it was actually shocking, even though I kind of knew, you know. So it just gave a bigger context for their adult lives, you know, which I think felt was important, making a film with adults as opposed to kids, you know, it's a different process. And then I also, at the same time, started interviewing them, sort of in a similar way I'd interviewed them before, which were these more abstract questions, you know, about life, death, what you dream of, you know, these not very specific. And then when they did have some specific stories, I sometimes did like a side interview about that. So one of the characters in the film, it's actually not in the film, but it has sort of still, it's still... the feeling of it is in there, but the specific story is not. But one of them almost got trafficked. You know, she had a story where she did pay somebody to leave and ended up in another country. And I think she was very close to being, you know, trafficked for sex, prostitution. So there was things like that, that in some of it we thought, okay, this is too much, or this is like a whole, you know, a whole film in itself, and something's it's made it lifetime. Into it. And then I sat down with those very long transcribed interviews, very, very big pile of papers, you know, like, you know, a lot of material, and sort of took what I had observed, what You know, and also there were things like Spessim, when we first approached him, he said, okay, I would like to be in the film, but religion is very important to me. And if I'm going to be in the film, I want to sing in the mosque and I want you to film it because that's what I do. I sing to prayer and I like it very much. And I want other people to see. So he really wanted people to see his religion. And I think for him, be inspired by it.
Mm.
You know, that's a different perspective for me. I respect his religious life. And I understand why it's there, but if you get into the content of it, I'm not comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, so it's in there in a way that hopefully, you know, I mean, if you wanted to do a more investigative documentary, you could do an investigative documentary as about how somebody becomes fundamentalized. You know, there's that story and those characters, but I sort of tried very hard to find a position in the film which had the respect for him without glossing over what was going on.
Mm.
You know, to be in that way truthful, you know. So in a way you could say my perspective on it is not in there. You know. And it's not his fully either. You know, it's not, you know, it's in that way it has an observational stance, you could say.
I mean, it's pretty striking to witness people who have had these experiences work out how they would like to represent themselves in telling their story in a fictional way. But it's, you know, of course, it's their lives as well. So it's this kind of, amazing power of watching someone play themselves, which was, striking, I think, and really unique. There's a vulnerability to that that's quite honest,
And just to explain the process a bit more, I mean, I would, you know, I did write a script based on the interviews and based on the observation. But, you know, we filmed in many stages. You know, I think we probably filmed 5 times. We went back and filmed. So there's a whole process in between over many years. You know, so the footage is probably, you know, from beginning to end over a 5-year period. You know, so I build up the story. So, I mean, I wouldn't go back and show them what we had filmed, but I would constantly show them, you know, things that I had written and discuss it with them, you know, like, and they could always say, I don't want to say this, or I don't want, you know, like Kasim, he said, you know, I don't want my actual father in the film. So it's an actor playing his father. It's in a location. It's not his home. But I saw his home. I knew how his father was.
Mm.
You know, we talked about that, you know. But he didn't want his father in the film. And you know, but it is his baby. He very much wanted his baby.
Yeah.
It's his baby. And his other daughter was supposed to be in the film, but it got too crazy just shooting with the 2 kids. And, you know, it was not, didn't work. But he wanted his immediate family in the film, but he didn't want his extended family, like his mother and father. So they're actors, but when they're sleeping in the room, his brother is next to him, his actual brother. Or like when Besnik, the wedding, you know, it's a bride that we hired. You know, it's an extra. But the woman sitting next to him and the man is his sister and his brother-in-law.
Hmm.
And the boy across is his nephew, you know. Wow. So
I wonder what it would have been like for them to have that experience of, you know, being on the set of their lives.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I always sort of emphasized how, you know, the fictionalized part, because I feel like it's also for them, it's a shield that they can always go behind.
Hmm.
You know, so from the beginning, I wanted to create some safe space in the film for them, which is a fictional space. You know, so, and the actor playing Kasim's father is a very famous actor in Kosovo.
Hmm.
He's a friend of mine, but he's, you know, super famous. He was in a comedy TV show. Everybody knows him. So I very much wanted him to be in the film because I thought, okay, they can hide behind Lou and all of them. Because if anybody says, well, you know, your life is, you know, if anybody wanted to badmouth a specific element in the film and, you know, put them in the media, they, and they wanted to say, well, it's just fiction, he would be in there as proof. So to an international audience, you know, he's not famous in that way, so it doesn't matter. But to a local audience, it does matter, I believe. We haven't shown it in Kosovo yet, but I did sort of... So the trafficker is also a Kosovo actor who's been in many films. The girl on the sofa who plays prostitute is an actress who people might recognize from TV. So and I sort of, you know, it's there to give them the ability to always say I was in a story. Because it's not important for me that it feels like, you know, there's autobiographical story. I don't think it's important. You know, it is true, but at the same time, I mean, they have complete ownership of the film, and, you know, they came to Berlin with me, and they very much own the story. You know, and they very much stand next to the story, and they very much stand next to it as, you know, in a strong way, I would say, you know, as somebody who survived, and they're proud of it, you know, so... But I didn't, I never wanted it to have this feeling of revelation, even though it's very revealing, actually. Does that make sense?
Totally, yeah.
But it's a little bit, you know, it's a little, so that's why I started by saying, you know, the question of docufiction, you know, starts to open up the question of what's true and what's not, which is just, you can see why it's an annoying question. It's also interesting, you know, it's interesting also because we've just talked about it, but actually, you know, pinpointing what's what is maybe not actually interesting.
I feel like that's kind of the point of the experience of watching it, you know, is that you I can't speak for everyone, I can speak for myself, but my mind was grasping for answers, you know, to questions, and then, you know, you do realize, you go, there's no merit in knowing the answer to that, or perhaps it doesn't even exist, you know, whether or not it's true, or, you know, how they felt about participating, or, you know, all of that sort of stuff is like, I think that's why it does open up a sort of difficult dialogue with yourself, you know, about how you perceive others who are far away, or if they've gone through something you haven't.
Exactly, and I do want it to be about the audience too. I mean, I do want people to sit and question their own role when they watch the film. I do, you know, I don't want them to, you know, I think we are able as audiences to hide a little too much, you know, like to just sit comfortably back, lean back comfortably, you know. So I did want to. You know, it's a more passive position. And I do wish for the audience not to feel completely pacified by the film.
Oh, well, that, like, you know, particularly, like, the whispering for me was, like, just so powerful. Being whispered to like that, sort of, you know, there's no choice but to be drawn into the lives of, you know, being on the other end of receiving a secret.
Yeah,
really striking.
Yeah. And the whole film is, you know, it's a fiction and a big secret at the same time. You know, it is both, you know, like, I mean, actually, you know, when we filmed the story where Shivia leans against her actual mother, who is a really, you know, warm, lovely woman who's been through a lot, right? And I thought, and Shiva has a really strong relationship to her mother. You know, it really is when she says in the film, you know, my mother means everything. It's true. It's what she says. And I thought, oh God, you know, like she's sitting and leaning against the mother and says, I don't tell my mother everything, you know, and so in a way, you know, and her mother is a little hard of hearing. So I'm a little unsure that she even hear it.
Oh, you know? Yeah, wow. Yeah. That's where the ambiguity, the power lives in that ambiguity, you know?
Yeah. And I thought, well, you know, Shiva has decided to say it leaning against her mother, so she's okay with it. Mm. So it's her choice, right? She didn't have to do it. You know, I mean, we had other instances where I had written something in the script that I also knew was true, mm. where they said, no, we can't put that in. And we took it out on the day, you know, I just took it out. I was like, okay, it would have been powerful, but it's not there.
You have to read the room a bit in a live sense.
It's just, I mean, there was always negotiations, yeah. you know, about, you know, also, you know, when Spresim and Besnik, when they pray, you know, they were like, we want you to film us to pray. And, you know, like somebody said, you can't film people praying. I said, well, they demanded it, so I did it, you know.
There's no guidebook, you know, yeah. There's no rules.
Yeah, and Spresim would check with the imam, you know, I think he checked with the imam what we did, mm. you know. It's obviously, you know, so he had a process for that himself, which maybe other people would say that's not right, but for him it was right. Mm. That was his process. And I didn't start to question that. Like, I didn't start to say, well, we shouldn't film Muslims praying. You know, I just thought, that's his choice. You know, mm. if he wants to be filmed, he should do it.
Yeah.
And for example, you know, because they do pray on the street like that. And he did get to approve all the locations where we shot it. You know, like, can we do it here? And we had one instance where he said, no, there's a woman's dress. I can't pray in front of a woman's dress. And I was like, oh, God, I never thought about that. You know?
Yeah.
I just thought it was beautiful. You know, I was just looking for the image.
Yeah.
So there was constantly, you know, something like that happening.
Sounds like there were a lot of filmmakers present as it was being put together.
Yeah, or certainly a lot of thoughts and opinions and reflections, mm. you know, and negotiations. But I never tried to venture into something where people were not happy. You know, I mean, it wasn't difficult because it was never my intention,
mm.
you know, like I'd have, you know, I think if you do investigative journalism or, you know, other types of documentary, you know, a lot of traditional documentary was meant to move characters into an area that they were maybe would surprise them or
mm.
would reveal something with them or, you know, and I had no agenda like that whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's not a film. In that way, you know, and I think really good documentaries, they do that, you know. Like a friend of mine who's a really good documentary filmmaker, he said, sometimes you have to be a real asshole to make a good documentary.
Mm.
You know, it's yeah. kind of one of the dirty secrets of that. And, you know, and with this fictionalized form, you stay clear of that.
Mm.
You know, because you have the storytelling, you can go into the storytelling or you can lift yourself out of the hard truth,
mm.
right? And still tell what you want to tell without exposing.
Mm. It's very humanist. The other thing that I wanted to mention was the soundtrack. I found it like so sick. It was like, it was very sort of reminded me of being in a club. It was kind of quite modern and like electronic and dark, but also a bit cheeky. Like there was something brooding about it. What was your thinking there?
I mean, I think you're responding to Eric Scotvin's soundtrack.
Yeah.
And Christian Eidnes, who's the sound designer, is a fabulous sound designer.
Mm.
You know, and I think the thing about Eric's music is that it's almost not music, it's almost sound design.
Yeah.
You know, it's like soundscape also mm. as well as music. And then in the sound design with Christian, we very much, you know, I always wanted to have storytelling outside of the picture.
Mm.
So we have layers of story. It's not shot.
Mm.
You know, you can always hear the neighbor. There's always like the family next door, the neighbors above,
yeah.
the street, people on the street. You know, there's a huge amount of sound design to create this larger universe.
And it brings the city to life as well, as a character almost, yeah.
And we really worked very hard on that. You know, it's very, it's really trying to create like, this place in a very sort of prominent way
mm.
where I think some sound design, you know, you don't want to disturb the main story and we're constantly disturbing.
Yeah.
You know, with music and, you know, it has a ton of pop songs.
Yeah.
You know, it has a huge, you know, it has Eric's very atmospheric soundtrack, and then it has so much pop.
Mm.
We have, you know, I don't remember how cute, 28 cues or something, you know, really a lot for a film like this, of pop, pure pop.
I think it really, it takes away that sentimentality, you know, when you put music that people listen to every day in to tell the story, and it's real, and it's, I don't know.
I really like Kosovo pop. I truly like it. You know, and it's also very true to being in that place. You know, you actually, you know, if you're somebody who likes peace and quiet, don't go there. I mean, everywhere there's music.
No, the reggaeton is so, like, iconic. Yeah.
You can hear music and birds and traffic everywhere in that city. Mm. You know, it's just... So I also just wanted to create this feeling of bombardment of sound that's very true. And I also think living lives that they live, you know, one of the things about living that kind of life is you don't have, you know, you don't have peace of mind.
Mm.
There's constantly, you know, you don't have the same level of privacy and the same level of peace than if you live a more privileged life.
Mm.
I also wanted to just have that feeling present in the film.
Mm. Yeah.
And then I just love that kind of sound design. And Christian, you know, I mean, he's one of the most, he's done all Lars von Trier's films. If you Google him, you'll see he's just a masterful sound designer.
Yeah, it was amazing. Well, Brigitte, thank you so much for speaking.
Thank you. It was a total pleasure.
Thanks to Ruby for doing this interview with the director of After War, which screened earlier this year at the Sydney Film Festival. Make sure to head over to thecurb.com.au to keep track of other interviews and reviews, and to keep track of where After War will be screening in the future. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you on the next episode.